The Dow continues its plunge, Biden adds to his lead, and the left claims a victory in Illinois. Trying to balance health concerns with campaign news on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Some states postpone their primaries, some go ahead with the voting. Either way, it's a mixed signal that leads to confusion and uncertainty.
One of the key methods here is going to be vote by mail. You know, I think that's going to be what potentially can relieve a lot of these problems.
Plus, is holding presidential debates without a studio audience so bad after all?
It's fine to have an audience for a debate if that audience remains a non-participant. But as soon as the audience becomes a factor, then it seems to me that the whole purpose of the exercise is defeated.
And we remember a terrorist attack on the House of Representatives 66 years ago.
Ruthless, fanatic violence erupted in the halls of Congress. Three men and a woman believed to be members of the Puerto Rican nationalist gang that in November 1950 attempted the assassination of President Truman opened fire from the visitors' gallery of the House of Representatives.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and lean to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 320 of The Political Junkie. Standing 6 feet away from you, I'm Ken Rudin. By now, it seems like most of America is finally on the same page when it comes to seeing the severity of the coronavirus. For a long time, for far too long of a time, there were those, mostly Republicans and Fox News folks, who were dismissing the gravity of the situation. Here was California Congressman Devin Nunes with Fox News host Maria Bartiromo.
We were just talking about the economy. And there's a lot of concerns with the economy here because people are scared to go out. But I will just say, one of the things you can do, if you're healthy, you and your family, it's a great time to just go out, go to a local restaurant.
Yeah.
Likely you can get in easily. There's, you know, let's not hurt the working people in this country that are relying on wages and tips to keep their small business
going.
On Tuesday, that came to a stop for the most part as President Trump addressed the nation on the severity of the crisis. But for all the seriousness he exhibited on Tuesday, it came after weeks and weeks of downplaying and dismissing. This was at a White House news conference in February.
Because of all we've done, the risk to the American people remains very low. We've had tremendous success beyond what people would have thought. But we're very, very ready for this, for anything, whether it's going to be a breakout of larger proportions or whether or not we're at that very low level. And we want to keep it that way. So we're at the low level. As they get better, we take them off the list so that we're going to be pretty soon at only 5 people. And we could be at just 1 or 2 people over the next short period of time. So we've had very good luck.
And here he was in Mar-a-Lago earlier this month, sitting next to the president of Brazil.
The really important, and I think you can say this for your country, I think we can say it for a lot of countries, for all countries, hopefully, it goes away. It's going away. We want it to go away with very, very few deaths. People have, we call it cases. How many cases do you have? Well, relative to other countries, we have very few cases. Relative to certain of the major countries that really have a bigger problem than us.
Our way of life has changed, that's for sure, as long as the virus is spreading and people are dying. It's good the president recognizes what's at stake, but it's regrettable that it took as long as it did. On the campaign front, the rallies are gone, but the battle for the presidency continues. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders held a debate last Sunday, not in Phoenix, as scheduled, but at the CNN studios in Washington, where there was no audience and no handshake, just an elbow bump. And 2 days later, on Tuesday, was another great day for Biden, the comeback kid, who won all 3 primaries at stake, in Florida, Illinois, and Arizona. It was a somber Biden who gave a muted speech that night, alone on a platform in his home state of Delaware. Most of the 5.5 minutes were dedicated to the severity of the virus. But he did offer this.
Senator Sanders and his supporters have brought a remarkable passion and tenacity to all of these issues. And together, they have shifted the fundamental conversation in this country. So let me say, especially to the young voters who have been inspired by Senator Sanders, I hear you. I know what's at stake. I know what we have to do. Our goal as a campaign, and my goal as a candidate for president, is to unify this party, and then to unify the nation.
With the timetable of upcoming primaries in flux, with all attention on the sacrifices and efforts being made to fight the pandemic, it's hard to see what path Sanders has to win the nomination. Even more important, the justification for continuing his candidacy. One thing we have noticed, as of Wednesday, the day after going 0-for-3 in the primaries, Sanders' campaign has no active ads on Facebook. That could prove to be significant. If the battle for the presidential nomination is coming to an end, the battle for control of Congress is just starting up. On Tuesday, Illinois became the 7th state to hold House and Senate primaries this year, and the first casualty was recorded. In the state's 3rd district, Congressman Dan Lipinski, a conservative Democrat who opposes abortion rights and who is one of the rare Democrats who voted against Obamacare and who even refused to endorse the president in 2012, lost to Marie Newman, a progressive who came close to defeating him 2 years ago. Lipinski first won the seat in 2004 after his father, Bill Lipinski, retired after 20 years. Lipinski's defeat begs the question as to whether anti-abortion candidates still have a home in the Democratic Party. And it begs another question, this week's trivia question. Who was the last woman to unseat a male incumbent of her own party in a House primary? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I'm just sitting here, beating on my trumpet, with all these promises you left for me. But where are you tonight, sweet Marie?
The coronavirus has wreaked havoc all over the world and, of course, all over the United States. Schools have closed, restaurants have closed, sporting events have been canceled, flights have been canceled. No groups of 50, no groups of 10. No more political rallies, not by President Trump, not by Joe Biden, not by Bernie Sanders. And what's the effect on the primaries? A mixed bag. It started last week with the announcement that Georgia would postpone its presidential primary for nearly 2 months.
Starting with breaking news tonight at 9, Georgia's presidential primaries postponed because of fears over the coronavirus.
State elections officials saying tonight the primaries will now be moved from March 24th to May 19th.
That move came shortly after this announcement from the Louisiana Secretary of State.
We have requested postponing the April 4th primary election until June 20th. And postponing the May 9th general election until July 25th.
Three other states, Kentucky, Maryland, and Ohio, also postponed their primary dates. Ohio did so on Monday, just one day before the scheduled primary date. Florida, Arizona, and Illinois went ahead as if everything were normal. But nothing is normal in this time of COVID-19, and that certainly includes how it has affected this year's campaigns. If government officials are finally telling people to stay home, then how does that comport with trying to get people out to vote? And if the virus continues to be dangerous, what does that say about the future of voting this year? Primaries may be postponed, but how many? What about this summer's conventions? And, the greatest fear of all, what if the November elections need to be pushed back? Rick Hassan knows more about election law than anyone I could think of. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California at Irvine. He's also the author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. And he writes the invaluable Election Law blog. Rick, to paraphrase the Nixon campaign in 72, we need you now more than ever.
Well, it's unfortunate that we're speaking under these circumstances.
Well, okay, so I want you to talk me down from this ledge. But it seems like what happened on Tuesday has left us with far more questions than answers, and hopefully I'll get to all of them. And let me start with Florida. It has a decidedly elderly population. Our seniors, the most vulnerable to this virus, are told to stay home. At the same time, Florida is holding its primary as if nothing changed. Something feels wrong here.
Well, you know, it was kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation on Tuesday, because on the one hand, there are problems with trying to call off an election at the last minute, including questions about whether or not governors have authority to do so. There's a real issue as to whether or not the Ohio governor could have done what he did legally.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a kind of a troubling precedent. On the other hand, going forward, when you not only have voters who are afraid to come to the polls, but you have a shortage of poll workers and election judges, I mean, that's not a good situation either.
I was going to say, and if election workers are forced to call in sick on primary day, theoretically, that would lead to more people waiting in line to vote, and that would mean larger crowds, right?
Right. So, you know, so yesterday was really maybe the worst situation because concern about the virus and precautions about the virus had really increased in a very significant way very quickly. For primaries that are coming up and for November, there's a chance to do more planning. And I think, well, you know, one of the key methods here is going to be vote by mail. And, you know, I think that's going to be what potentially can relieve a lot of these problems looking ahead.
Rick, let me go back to Ohio, which you mentioned. That seemed incredibly confusing because on Monday, which is, as I said, the day before the primary, election officials said the vote should go on as scheduled. But then Governor Mike DeWine said, no, we need to postpone it. And so it was postponed. But, well, one, I mean, there's so many thoughts here. One, it seemed really unprofessional for the two sides to go public with their dispute in the midst of so much confusion. Two, why did they wait until the day before the election? And three, and this is the thing that you raised earlier, does state law allow DeWine to overrule his election officials and postpone the primary?
You know, I think that the question under state law is a complicated one, and I've heard different people with different opinions. I'm not an Ohio general government expert, but I do know that the governor himself, when there was this lawsuit that he apparently manufactured to try to get himself ordered to shut the election down, which didn't work, the governor had said he didn't have the unilateral power to do so. And so then what ended up happening is the chief health officer of the state closed the polling places, and at that point, the Secretary of State said, well, in order to preserve people's constitutional rights, we're extending things. But, you know, he made some decisions about how to extend it that I think Democrats were not happy with in terms of, you know, how long the extension was going to be and, you know, what was going to happen with ballots that came in later, whether they would be going to be treated as special provisional ballots. It's really kind of a mess in Ohio. And so, you know, I think it's uncertain as to whether the governor acted legally. I think, you know, he had public safety in mind. I don't think this was a illegitimate attempt to manipulate the election outcomes, but it does set a dangerous precedent. We do not want chief executives ordering people away from polling places in ways that could disenfranchise voters, which is, you know, again, one of the reasons why I think we need alternative means of casting ballots, like absentee ballots, so that people will have a chance to vote, even if there are problems.
Well, one, we know that there are efforts going on in many states already to disenfranchise voters, which has nothing to do with the coronavirus. That's been going on for years. But here's another question, though. Well, I mean, this is probably the bigger question. What if, for argument's sake, we were talking about November and not March? Could President Trump theoretically decide the election should be delayed? Does he have that power?
So the president doesn't have the power to set the election date. That's set by statute, and you know, it's a federal statute. And the 20th Amendment of the United States Constitution provides for what happens if there is no president chosen in time. You know, it like goes through a series of successions as to who would next become president. But what the president could potentially do is declare martial law or do something else that would keep people away from polling places. That's the real concern. And then, you know, we'd still have an election, presumably with either the votes that have been cast by absentee ballot or in those places where polls are open, or, and this is, you know, one of those nightmare scenarios of things that we've heard about before, we could have a situation where state legislatures decide, well, things are too uncertain. We're going to take back our power to appoint electors to the Electoral College directly. This may bring back memories of the 2000 Bush versus Gore decision. Back in that decision, the Supreme Court said, although state legislatures have given that power to the people in every state to vote for president, they can take it back at any time. And so that's one of the concerns I have now. Think of a place like Michigan or Pennsylvania with Republican legislatures, but perhaps a Democratic majority electorate.
Okay. Oh, boy. Well, let before we go to November, because that's frightening enough, but let's even just stay to the present. I see that Georgia, whose primary is next Tuesday, the 24th, has postponed their date. You have primary runoffs on the 31st in three states, including Alabama, which has a key Senate runoff.
As we're recording this, Alabama has moved its primary to July 14th. Just in the last 2 minutes as we're recording.
That's that Jeff Sessions, Tommy Tuberville Senate runoff, right?
I think that's the one, yes, that's being moved.
Okay, thank you for that. We break news on the Political Junkie. But then we have Louisiana, which is scheduled for April 4th, has postponed. But Wisconsin, for example, which is scheduled for April 7th, is saying that it would be difficult to postpone. And for now, it seems to be suggesting that the primary will go on as scheduled. I mean, why and what needs to be done to change it?
First of all, it takes time to prepare for the general election, and so you've got that. But also in terms of securing places where people can vote in person. You know, one of the problems that we saw in the earlier primaries in Illinois and Florida and Arizona was that schools didn't want people in there, and in some cases assisted living facilities closed, you know, all to the public. And so there's a lot of logistics associated with trying to get a primary going, and I'm not sure what the specifics are of Wisconsin, but moving primary dates is difficult, and trying to come up with what new rules and procedures are going to be in terms of deadlines, sometimes there's going to be a question about who has the authority to do that. So, you know, there are complex issues, and they differ from state to state.
Well, I read this on your blog, and I think this is, I mean, important to point out. You reported that there were reports of chaos, non-functional polling places, unsanitary conditions, and low turnout all across Illinois on Tuesday. So again, with so many election judges and volunteers not showing up, many people with absolutely no training were serving as election judges.
Right. That was me excerpting a BuzzFeed report about what was going on the ground in Illinois. I'm hoping that now that people have seen what happened in the most recent set of primaries, that there will be better planning and that there will be steps taken to assure that there's enough ways for people who are voting in person to vote safely, including, you know, the sanitizing of the areas and giving people space to be able to spread out if they are trying to vote in person.
Well, one of the solutions being discussed, and you mentioned this earlier, is for Congress to offer legislation that calls for every state to allow people to vote by mail and without needing an excuse to do so. I know there are a lot of states that have vote by mail, but you need a legitimate reason, like a doctor's note or you're traveling or something like that, right?
Right. And, you know, it may be that fear of getting coronavirus would count as enough of an excuse, but having to have people go through this and go through an administrative process is going to be burdensome on voters and burdensome on election administrators. And so I've suggested that Congress should mandate under its power in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 4, to set the manner of congressional elections, that every state allow no-excuse absentee balloting just for this November, not a permanent change in the rules. And that would just provide a great safety net for people to be able to ensure that they can be enfranchised without having to go to a polling place.
I mean, that makes complete sense. Do we know if the House is close to voting on something like that? And
well, there's a bill that's been proposed by Senators Wyden and Klobuchar in the Senate. According to a report in the Washington Post, someone, I don't know if it was a spokesperson for McConnell or someone close to McConnell, thought that this was more of a state issue. But Democrats will have some leverage. As David Leonard argued in a recent column, they can say, you know, if you want this stimulus package, you've got to throw in this election protection as well. So we'll have to watch and see what happens with that.
There are three states, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, that have vote by mail only. Is that working?
Yeah, I think that's working, but it's not the kind of thing that you can roll out for November. It took a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. It's a completely different model. And so, you know, I think proposals to move to all vote by mail are you know, just a bridge too far for this election. Of course, if a state wants to try and do it, sure, you know, if the state thinks they can manage it. But I wouldn't recommend that Congress foist that upon states when there's lots of things on the front burner right now. That would be quite an undertaking, even under perfect conditions.
I hate to keep bringing up more complications, but there's this real ID switch on October 1st that could also prove confusing, right? I mean, first of all, who's going to want to show up at a motor vehicle office if the virus is still rampant? But there are a lot of people who don't have driver's licenses, don't have these IDs, and that could, I wonder if that could have an impact on turnout in November.
Yes, right. So that's another thing that might have to be relaxed, or voter identification requirements. And, you know, the other thing that should be done is moving to online voter registration. Many states have it, but not all do. In a place like Texas, it is probably the biggest thing that needs to happen in order to assure that people can vote, is moving to online voter registration for the fall.
I didn't even mention the fears about the sanctity of the voting process, Russia and other outside influences. I mean, are we doomed? I'm always discouraged when I read about suppressed turnout and all the things going on in the different states. But with all these complications, with all these fears, and all the concerns about the sanctity of our vote, it just seems like we're in big trouble. Or do I sound like I'm too much of an alarmist?
Well, the good news is that November is still about 8 months away. We have time to try to fix things. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, if we don't plan it now, we're not going to be able to roll it out in September or October. We've got to get working now, because we see what happened in the recent voting in Illinois and in Florida.
Rick Hasson is a Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California at Irvine, and the author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. And he writes the invaluable Election Law blog, which you can conveniently find at electionlawblog.org. Rick, thank you for such an important conversation.
Thank you for having me on.
Sometimes there are moments in a presidential debate that you know are guaranteed to get a reaction from the live studio audience. Like the question from Henry Truett of the Baltimore Sun, President Ronald Reagan responded to during his second debate with challenger Walter Mondale in 1984.
You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truett, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Even Mondale laughed at that one. 4 years later, it was a comment made by Dan Quayle about the hypothetical demise of George Bush that led to a cutting response by Lloyd Benson in their vice presidential debate.
I have far more experience than many others that sought the office of vice president of this country. I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator Benson.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Okay, Quayle didn't laugh at that one. And what about the most dramatic statement at Sunday's debate between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders? Perhaps this one by Biden.
Number one, I committed that if I'm elected president and have an opportunity to appoint someone to the courts, I'll appoint the first black woman to the courts. It's required that they have representation now. It's long overdue. Secondly, if I'm elected president, my cabinet, my administration will look like the country. And I commit that I will, in fact, pick a woman to be vice president. There are a number of women who are qualified to be president tomorrow. I would pick a woman to be my vice president.
And as for the reaction in the hall, because of the coronavirus, because of the warnings against crowds of people, CNN decided to move the debate, scheduled for Phoenix, to its studios in Washington, where there would be no studio audience. Biden and Sanders had a serious debate. It displayed their strengths and their weaknesses. One thing we didn't see or hear was an audience reaction. And given how boisterous and sometimes rude these audiences can be, that may not be a bad thing. That's why it's time to talk to Alan Schroeder, professor emeritus at the Northeastern University School of Journalism and the author of Presidential Debates. Alan, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, you know, sometimes, and I'm sure you feel the same way, but sometimes debates remind me of the Roman Colosseum or maybe even a hockey game with everything about the hits and the errors and the gaffes and the gotcha moments. Without a studio audience, you know, people aren't worried about, the candidates weren't worried about punchlines or playing to the crowd. And so I thought that Biden and Sanders may not have been perfect, but it felt like a really substantive debate.
It did feel like a substantive debate. And I think, you know, the thing with audiences is that it's fine to have an audience for a debate if that audience remains a non-participant. But as soon as the audience becomes a factor, then it seems to me that the whole purpose of the exercise is defeated. I mean, these are debates not for the people in the hall, but for the tens of millions of viewers at home. And so anything that gets in the way of that is problematic. So I think not having that audience was a really interesting example of what debates could be, and frankly, what they used to be, because in 1960, the Kennedy-Nixon debates were all in television studios, no audiences whatsoever.
Who of the two candidates, Biden or Sanders, does better with an audience?
I think probably Biden is more someone who cares about having an audience there and maybe feeds off of their energy. But Bernie's audiences are so exclusively oriented toward him and everything that he says, so they always give him a little boost just via their enthusiasm. So I think each of them would have gained a little something by having an audience there. You know, the moment, and you played it there, of Biden announcing his pick for the vice president, I kept thinking when I was watching that debate that, you know, had there been an audience there, the applause and the cheering would have gone on for 30 seconds or so before Bernie had a chance to respond. So, you know, in some ways, the lack of an audience is kind of artificial, and I guess also because we're used to seeing audiences there, but we really didn't miss them when they weren't there the other night.
And I also wonder, you know, I was obviously watching Biden as well, and it seems like Bernie Sanders always has a very good, more than competent, relaxing debate style. I mean, he may say the same thing every time, but he says it better than anybody else. Whereas Biden, I think, has had some poor debate performances. He's stiff. They talk about his former stutter, but he just seems uncomfortable. But I thought that watching Biden last Sunday seemed like he was even more relaxed, knowing it was just the panel of moderators in the room.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I would also think that having only one other person to debate against was a big factor for him, too. You know, Biden's an interesting guy in debates because he's been at it since 1988 at the presidential level. And in primary debates, he's had a few good moments over the years, but that has never really been his thing. And yet in his one-on-ones, if you think about his debate with Sarah Palin, his debate against Paul Ryan, he was really good in both of those debates and good in very different ways. So I think some of it maybe was the lack of a studio audience, but I think some of it also, frankly, was just it's a hell of a lot easier to debate against one other person than against nine other people.
Dismissing the conversation about the audience for one second, the backdrop to all of this is that there's a pandemic out there and people are panicking. And I'm watching on Sunday, I'm watching two men in their late 70s talking about the future. That felt a bit eerie.
Well, yeah, it did. And, the other sort of odd thing about that debate just visually was that 6 feet between the two lecterns, because, there's no earthly reason to have done that. And in fact, it goes against all camera production protocol, because you want the candidates close together so you can get that relationship shot. So, yeah, there was a lot of everything about that debate was just a little bit dissonant and yet kind of reassuring. There's been a lot of criticism that they didn't just talk about coronavirus and really make that the entire focus of that debate. But I think that there's some value in having conversations about other topics as well, and some sense of normalcy in hearing politicians talk about things other than what's, in front of us right this second.
What would you say are the pros and cons of debating before a studio audience?
Well, I think the live audience has become problematic, especially in primary debates, because these debates, which used to be sponsored and organized by civic organizations or local media, have become these national programs that are big ratings blockbusters that include high-priced ads that are sold by the networks that sponsor them. And so the networks, I think, are the ones that have really shifted the tone here by insisting on live audiences, and not just live audiences, but active live audiences, boisterous live audiences, because it's a better TV show, at least from the standpoint of the networks that put them on. So, I think there is a difference between general election live audiences for debates and primary debate audiences. And I think in the general elections, there's much more of an effort to kind of keep things under control and keep things polite. You played the Benson quail clip, and that gets a huge audience response. But that was back in 1988 when the debate commission did not do what it does now. The debate commission back then, people could just sit wherever they wanted to. So the Democrats organized the cheering section, put all their people in one place, and got them all pumped up. And today, in general election debates, that audience is interspersed. So the Democrats don't sit with the Democrats. The Republicans don't sit with the Republicans. The thought being that you can't get as much of a cheering section going. But that's the general election debates. I do think the primary debates, because of the network involvement, have become much more theatrical in a lot of ways. And audience is just one of those.
I mentioned the Benson Quayle debate and the Reagan-Mondale debate as two examples of when the audience made its feelings quite clear about what they were seeing and hearing. Can you think of any other examples of when audiences may have played a role or influenced how people at home viewed the debates?
I'm sure there are, especially in the primary debates, but at the general election, in the general election debates, not so much. It really isn't that that studio audience that sort of shapes perceptions. In the, in some of the Republican debates in 2016 with Trump and all of his various rivals, I think that audience did have a big effect. And to some extent, that audience was an anti-Trump audience. He got actually booed quite a bit. But That becomes part of his shtick. Yes, he likes having an enemy like that.
I was thinking the same thing. You're absolutely right. Trump was often booed at these Republican debates back in 2016. I want to play a piece of tape when Trump is being especially dismissive of Jeb Bush at a debate in New Hampshire.
Let me just, he wants to be a tough guy. A lot of times you'll have, and it doesn't work very well.
Tough is it to take property from an elderly woman?
Let me talk quiet.
How tough is it?
That's all of his donors and special interests out there. So, that's what it is. That's what. And by the way, let me just tell you, we needed tickets. You can't get them. You know who has the tickets for the? I'm talking about to the television audience, donors, special interest, the people that are putting up the money. So it is. The RNC told us we have all donors in the audience, and the reason they're not loving me.
You know, Alan, audiences can cheer, and we know they can boo as well.
Absolutely. And you know, it's got to be unsettling for the candidate on the stage to be booed. You know, another thing with audiences that I think is problematic is they're really noisy, not just, you know, for those of us watching at home, but they affect the ability of the candidates to hear even the questions. You know, think how many times in watching primary debates where because the audience is still cheering or applauding, the candidate will have to ask the moderator to repeat the question. It's just not an ideal thing, especially a big audience. And you know, some of these primary debates have packed the audiences with hundreds and hundreds of people. You know, Ken, there's another reason that audiences exist for debates, and that is that the campaigns themselves like to be able to reward their supporters with seats in the audience. And so you see this in the general election debates, you see this in the primary debates. You know, part of what goes on is it's a big sort of, you know, gift that you can give your supporters if you can get them a seat in the audience. So the campaigns themselves have kind of a, you know, on the one hand, it's bad for the candidates, but on the other hand, it's a chance to curry favor with their donors.
And let's not forget, if memory serves, when Lincoln and Douglas debated for that Senate seat in Illinois in 1858, they were not on television. It was a live audience, right?
Yeah, it was a live audience who brought, you know, picnic baskets and made a day of it. And, you know, it was a kind of an amazing phenomenon if you think about it that way. But my understanding is, you know, there was some audience reaction, but certainly the audience were not active participants to the degree that the candidates were.
And, you know, what I love about your book, Presidential Debates, and I've said this for so many years because I think it is the Bible for learning about what happened in presidential debates. But when Gerald Ford said that thing about, you know, no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, that so-called gaffe in 1976, it was actually not the audience that responded. It was Max Frankel who said, wait a minute, did I just hear you correctly? So sometimes, I mean, it seems to be getting worse because back then it was a journalist who said, wait a second, let me see if I understood what you just said, and not, you know, hooting and hollering from the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, everybody thinks of that in retrospect as such a gotcha question, but it wasn't a gotcha question at all. It was just a ridiculously stupid answer. And Max Frankel, the New York Times journalist who posed the question, really gave Ford a lot of opportunity to dig himself out, and Ford did not recognize that that's what was being done there. So he just dug his heels in, and it went on for days until finally they had to clean it up.
Yeah. Do you see any chance in the world for a return to the no audience? You know, I mean, it's like giving up, you know, it's like giving up the laugh track on TV sitcoms.
Well, you know, that this situation that we find ourselves in right now is causing a lot of rethinking of a lot of things that we took for granted. So maybe the debates would be affected by that. But I do think that this idea of the campaigns themselves wanting audiences so that they can reward their supporters, I think that's going to be a practical factor that will probably mean that debates will continue to include audiences, not to mention the fact that the networks sponsor of them seem to like that extra energy. So you know, we'll see. It certainly was an experiment worth having, and I think one that showed that we don't necessarily need live audiences. But whether that's a game changer for the rest of debate history, I'm not willing to go quite that far.
Yeah, and I agree with you, but I'm just thinking 2 hours on a Sunday night, a debate with no live audience, I didn't miss it. I just liked hearing from the two candidates. And I thought, even if it's for just one brief shining moment, it worked.
Yeah, it did work. It did work. And I think that maybe if the candidates themselves come around to the point of view where it's better for them, then they can, you know, they hold enough clout, especially in the primary debates, that they might be able to make that part of the deal. Or the DNC or the RNC or whichever national organization is involved in sponsoring. But they have to see a benefit in it. Let's face it, politicians always do what's best for them. So if they don't like having an audience there, then maybe that's the change that will be made in the future.
Alan Schroeder is professor emeritus at the Northeastern University School of Journalism and the author of Presidential Debates. Alan, it is always great having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Ken. I enjoyed it.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, name the last person to defeat a former U.S. Attorney General in a Senate race. The answer, Harris Wofford, a Pennsylvania Democrat who was appointed in 1991 to fill the Senate seat of the late John Hines. Wofford then went on to defeat former Governor and U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh in a special Senate race. And the randomly selected winner is David Salter of Idlewild, California. David wins a coveted political junkie button. We'll let you know the next time a scuttle button appears on our website. Until then, you can find our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Earlier this month, a man by the name of Rafael Miranda died. He was 89 years old. For those who are unfamiliar with that name, he was the last surviving member of a group of four Puerto Rican nationalists who got into the U.S. Capitol on a March afternoon in 1954 and opened fire on members of the House from above. Five congressmen were wounded, including one seriously. All survived. The gunmen, described as either terrorists or freedom fighters, depending on your point of view, wanted independence for Puerto Rico from the U.S. Following the attack and their arrest, they all spent a quarter century in prison before being pardoned by President Jimmy Carter. Miranda died on March 2nd. He died 66 years and one day after the attack in the House chamber. In the immediate aftermath of the incident, several House pages attended to the lawmakers who were shot, putting them on stretchers and getting them out of harm's way. One of those pages was Paul Kanjorski, who decades later served some 26 years in the House as a Democrat from Pennsylvania until his defeat in 2010. 4 years ago, we had him on the Political Junkie to talk about that harrowing moment. We are replaying that interview. In your memory, when you look back at that day, how did that day start?
It was an average day, and we just got into average material on the floor. And then all of a sudden, this cut loose in the afternoon, early afternoon. And then, of course, we sort of functioned at our jobs without thinking about the long-term ramifications. But later on in the day, when we all got together and talked about it, it became apparent that we had lived through a significantly historical event.
Well, tell me, where were you when the shooting started? How old were you? Who were you working for? Tell me what you remember.
That was in my second year, as a page. And not all pages were there because that was the day the academy examinations for West Point and Annapolis, et cetera, were being held. So those that were interested in going to the academies were absent. So we were sort of on short shift, if you will. I was on the floor, and that means sitting in the corner back there and moving up in your seat until you get a ring on the floor to go service someone on the floor. And that's what I was doing. As a matter of fact, I was sitting in the first seat when the buzzer went off. I knew where it was, got up, took about four steps, and that's when it started. And it started in such a way that it sounded like firecrackers. But I realized very quickly that it was shots because as a kid, back in Pennsylvania, I'd spent a lot of time, you know, shooting pistols. And when a bullet hits a hard rock, it usually makes a particular ping, and it also causes the rock to shatter and fly. And that's what I felt right above my head. I heard one of the cracks hit the marble column, and it sprayed me. So I immediately concluded it was a bullet of some sort hit the floor.
How old were you at the time?
I was I was 15.
Wow. Do you remember the shooters yelling anything?
They unraveled a flag and were shouting in Spanish, I think, something about Puerto Rico independence. But, you know, I was not aware of the political circumstance in Puerto Rico and the striving for independence there. That was the furthest thing from my mind. Then we were, you know, doing other things. And, of course, you know, when you're Page, you said you spent some time on the Hill. But those of us that have been fortunate enough to spend time on the Hill get an adrenaline shot from it. So everything we do is so connected to important things, you know. And at that time, things were a lot less formal than they are now, so that it wouldn't be strange to walk around a corner and walk into the president, who may be visiting for a meeting up there, because that was rather common. Of course, if it were today, that wouldn't happen.
On that day, on March 1st, do you remember thinking that you might have been at risk of getting shot yourself?
Honestly, not. Those shots went out. I hit the floor. I got up. I went on to where the call section was. And then there were several members laying around the floor, somewhat moaning. And then so I zipped right back to Bill. Bill was right behind me.
Bill Emerson.
Yeah. And I said, you know, we've got some dangerous things here. Do we have any stretchers? And we sent some other pages to get stretchers. And we started right into response mode. So we didn't really give a lot of thought or think about our own involvement in it until it was over later on in the afternoon.
When we mentioned Bill Emerson, let me just point out, he was a page with you back in the day, and then he also later served in Congress, as you did. He was a Republican from Missouri. There's a famous photograph of you among those carrying a stretcher out of the House chamber. I mean, I just remember both Bill Emerson is like pointing or yelling, and you're holding up the stretcher. That, I mean, for a 15-year-old, that must have been a surreal day.
It was an issue. We carried three members out. There were five members injured, and Bill and I had a team. We had about five or six pages and a stretcher, and we would go in and out and carry them down to the ambulances, which were in the parkade down there in front of the Capitol. And then finally, when we got the last one out, we actually got into the ambulance and went to the hospital with them.
Somebody said that you can still see the bullet holes in the House chamber and some of the desks today?
Oh, yes. The majority, there's a beautiful shot that went through the table on the majority leader or minority leader, depending, on the Republican side of the chamber. And it's been filled in, but it's very clear that it's a bullet hole. And then there are some other bullet holes in the ceiling that are still observable. And now they've did a pretty good patch job on the columns. For instance, the column that got hit just in front of me when I got up, you really have to know that there was a shot fired, and that's been filled in. It's practically totally removed.
You first ran for Congress in the 1980s.
1980 election, right, a special election.
Right, and then you were elected in 84. When you were elected and when you were on the House floor, did memories of this event come back to you?
Oh, there's really never a day that I go on the House floor that I don't remember that occasion, where it happened, where the location was of people. And the chamber hasn't changed that much since 1954. I mean, the carpet is, you know, a different color and everything. And course, you know, off and on over those last 62 years. Wow. And, of course, Bill now is deceased, but Bill and I carried on a lifetime friendship. And so he stayed on the Hill and worked on the staff and then eventually as chief of staff to some of the senators. And then he ran in 80 and I ran in 80. He was a Republican, I was a Democrat. He won, I lost, and didn't come back for another 4 years. But then we spent, you know, the next 20, not 20, but about 15 years together telling stories about what happened and enjoyed ourselves. It was sort of those weird things that you have a childhood friendship. See, we were also roommates, and we were really best of friends. And he traveled to my home at vacations. I traveled to his home. We visited each other in college, in law school. You know, it was a long-term. I remember bringing my wife up to meet him right after he got married. He was in Washington. So we had a real long, involved friendship. And then Joanne served with me after Bill died.
Joanne, Bill Emerson's widow, yes.
Right. And she is a wonderful girl. But we were all very, very, very close.
It was like yesterday, wasn't it?
No. Puerto Rico has a special meaning to me because of that event now. And I imagine that won't leave me until my days are over. So, you know, if I could leave another word off this depressing subject, I wish that we hadn't done away with the Page program because there were so many of us that had the opportunity to have that experience and then come back to Washington to serve. And I'm sure I probably would have never run for Congress and served in Congress those 26 years, nor would have Bill, if we hadn't been pages. That's where we decided what we wanted to do with the rest of our lives.
Paul Kanjorski is a Democrat from Pennsylvania who served 26 years in Congress from 1985 through 2010. Congressman, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us.
Ken, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad I still have the memories to share with you.
In Washington, D.C., ruthless, fanatic violence erupted in the halls of Congress. Three men and a woman believed to be members of the Puerto Rican nationalist gang that in November 1950 attempted the assassination of President Truman opened fire from the visitors' gallery of the House of Representatives. Estimates of the numbers of shots fired range from 15 to 30. And each bullet hole found is a grim reminder to those who were present of the terrible surprise attack.
Ambulances are rushed to the Capitol, along with doctors from a nearby naval hospital. Alvin Bentley, wounded near the heart and in the stomach, is carried out while police push our cameraman aside. Bentley's condition is still reported as critical. Clifford Davis, a Democrat leader, was wounded in the right leg. In the excitement, a doorkeeper, William Belcher, suffered a heart attack. Republican Ben Jensen received several severe wounds in the back. Many other congressmen escaped death by inches in the chamber.
It was 66 years ago, on March 1, 1954, when an act of terror on the House floor injured five lawmakers and made headlines everywhere. The last surviving member of that Puerto Rican nationalist group, Rafael Miranda, died earlier this month at age 89. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. And Ben Scaldini is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. And please, Stay safe, everyone.